Hello, this is Ian Harper welcoming you to the first Business of Weather podcast produced in association with Asia Climate Forum, Asia's largest event dedicated to addressing climate change, flooding and poor air quality. In each program, we'll investigate the increasing impact of extreme weather and climate change on business and look at how weather technology and information services can help address the growing challenges. We'll also spotlight the new opportunities for entrepreneurs and business startups seeking to exploit the business potential of technology innovations to help those affected by extreme weather. Now, many pundits believe that the opportunity to arrest climate change simply by reducing our carbon emissions has passed. They believe that if we are to keep the rise in global temperatures below 1.5 or 2 degrees, we'll have to resort to some form of climate engineering. For example, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or seeding the atmosphere with chemicals to reflect sunlight. Our first guest is Louise Charles, who works for the Swiss company Climeworks. They're pioneering technology which can literally suck carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then turn it into useful products. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
Right, to start off with, what is Climeworks direct air capture technology, and what does it actually do?
So, Climeworks, we are a Swiss company. We build machines, and these machines essentially capture CO2 directly from ambient air. This technology is then known as direct air capture. So it's not an important distinction. It's not CO2 from point source or flue gas. It's really directly from the air.
So anywhere, they can go anywhere, these machines?
They can go anywhere, correct.
You could put them on a hillside or in a city.
You could put them anywhere. Anywhere you have some kind of energy source. So we do need energy to power those machines. So anywhere there is a clean or renewable energy source available, we can build those machines.
How big are they?
So we build them in a modular way. And these modules we call CO2 collectors. And we can essentially stack these collectors as we please, kind of play Lego with them. The current size of one collector is like a small car, so or a very, very large, oversized washing machine.
And are they portable like a car?
They're not portable, no. No, they stay where we build them.
Okay. Who developed the technology? How much has it cost to date, and where has the funding come from?
So to the first part of the question, who developed the technology? Climeworks was founded a decade ago by two mechanical engineers, Jan Wurzbacher and Christoph Gebold. They did their bachelor's and their master's and then PhDs at ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology in Switzerland, on the topic of direct air capture. After the PhDs, they went on to found Climeworks as a spin-off company from ETH. The cost was the second part of the question. So currently it costs Climeworks about $600 to capture 1 ton of CO2 from the air. And the third part of the question you'll have to remind me of.
Where's the funding come from? How much money has gone into the project so far?
So where the funding has come from, multiple places so far. So in total, Climeworks has raised about $50 million. The last financing round was last summer, where we closed at $30 million, and our financing is a mixture of private investment. So we have a consortium of private investors, and there is public funding that we have also received. We're involved in various EU R&D projects, Horizon 2020, for example. The Swiss government is involved, the German government likewise. So it's a mix between public and private investment currently.
What would it cost a client to use this technology, and can it really help address the issue of global warming and climate change?
So it what it costs customers, so we as Climeworks, we build the machines, we develop the technology. And what we do then with that CO2 is sell it on to customers at market price. So the various industries worldwide that are large off-takers of CO2 already, the beverage industry, for example, to make fizzy drinks fizzy, they require CO2. Agricultural industry use CO2 as an airborne fertilizer. There's more and more effort and research going into the synthesis of renewable fuels, for which CO2 is one of the key ingredients. So customers are at this point paying market price for air captured CO2.
So the customer doesn't actually buy the technology. You use your technology and sell them the CO2 that's captured.
Precisely. Yeah, we develop the technology. We build the plants currently. That may then change in the future, but currently we are the ones building those direct air capture plants. We sell the CO2 on to others for use in their products. So be that in drinks, in greenhouses, in fuels, selling the CO2 as a raw material. Alongside that, what we also do is offer a service to companies, to individuals, to reverse their emissions. And the way that works is that we build, again, our direct air capture machines. We remove the CO2 from the air. We then mix it with water within the framework of the CarbFix project in Iceland currently. That fizzy water CO2 mixture is pumped underground, where it reacts with basalt and is turned into stone. So there we have a carbon dioxide removal service, which we are offering to, as I say, corporates or individuals wanting to reverse their emissions.
How big is this market for the CO2 captured by your technology? I mean, you've invested a lot of money in this technology, so what sort of rate of return do you think the company can make on the sale of the CO2?
So the markets that we're active in are the large. So the first being the food, beverage and agriculture industry. So as mentioned, they're large off-takers of many millions of tons of CO2 per year for their drinks, for their greenhouses. The renewable fuels market is one that is still in development. And there we estimate also billions of tons of CO2 required then in the coming years as we move away from fossil fuels and instead power our transport systems with carbon neutral fuels, which require air captured CO2 to be carbon neutral. And this third market, the carbon dioxide removal, is of the three really the largest. So if we take the numbers from various climate reports, the IPCC special report, they've clearly stated that to make or stand any chance of making those climate targets the world has set itself of limiting global warming to beneath 1.5 or 2 degree temperature rise, then we will need to be doing everything we can to reduce emissions, but on top of that, additionally remove CO2 directly from air. Okay. And there, the market we're talking is billions of tons a year.
Okay, who are the clients who are using the CO2 captured by your technology? I mean the names, which companies, which organizations are actually using this CO2? Can you give me any names?
I can give you some names, yeah, sure. The list is growing longer. One of the very first customers was Audi. So they're looking into creating carbon neutral renewable fuels using air captured CO2. We're working also with Coca-Cola, HBC Switzerland. They're using air captured CO2 in their sparkling water, Volzer. We have the greenhouse Gebrüder Meyer outside of Zurich. They are using our CO2 as an airborne fertilizer in their greenhouse. So the higher the concentration of CO2 within their greenhouse, the better those crops can grow. They have a better crop yield, 20%, to name a few.
Okay. Now, Won't climate engineering technologies such as your direct air capture encourage companies to continue on a business as usual basis rather than taking action to become more energy efficient or cutting their carbon footprints in other ways?
We believe not. I mean, the climate reports I've mentioned, IPCC in particular, they clearly state that to make these climate targets, it's not enough just to reduce. So we also have to remove. So we're at a point now that the climate crisis is so severe, we cannot pick and choose. So it's not a question of either or, it's rather and. We need all of these climate efforts and solutions to be working together. And we see Climeworks as part of a portfolio of different solutions which are required to tackle this problem.
Now, finally, is Climeworks working on any other types of climate engineering technologies?
No, Climeworks' focus is on direct air capture only.
Okay, well, that concludes the interview. Thank you very much, Louise.
Thank you. Thank you for the interest.
You're listening to Business of Weather, produced in association with Asia Climate Forum, Asia's largest event dedicated to addressing climate change, flooding, and poor air quality. Now, there's one resource in particular that's critical to life as we know it, and its availability is heavily influenced by climate change. According to the United Nations, by 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will face a shortage of it, although in 1 year, the average American household uses nearly 500 tonnes of it. In Nairobi, the urban poor pay 10 times more for it than New Yorkers, while some 30 tonnes of it are required to grow a day's food for a family of four. Some 80% of all illness in the developing world is related to it, and there is about the same amount of it on Earth now as there was millions of years ago. It is, of course, water. And to talk about it, I've invited leading expert Dr. Mark Fletcher, the global water leader of Arup, onto the show to answer a few questions about this precious resource. Now, some people have said that the supply of fresh water is effectively a finite resource. Is this the case?
Well, we need to sort of value the fresh water we have, of course, and use it more efficiently. But specifically answering your question, no. With treatment, we have a significant resource called the ocean. With decreasing energy prices, the option to remove salt and impurities from the sea is becoming increasingly more economic. The energy sources are renewable, then this could be a very positive option. There are fossil freshwater sources that aren't replenished. Abstracting those isn't sustainable in the long term.
So fresh water isn't quite finite, but it's nearly finite. But water itself, which we can drink, is infinite if we can desalinate the ocean.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Now, the world's population is expected to rise from almost 8 billion now to nearly 10 billion by 2050. This is being accompanied by rapid urbanisation, and the 55% of the world's population now living in urban areas is predicted to increase to 70% by 2050. How is urbanisation affecting the supply of fresh water?
Well, it's concentrating people in specific locations, so it's increasing demand. Unless we can change human behaviour, this increase in human population will increase that demand considerably. So we need to look at using water more efficiently at a personal level, improving water efficiency of industry and agriculture, consider much more reuse and recycling of water at a quality appropriate for its use.
Right. Now, what impact is climate change having on the world's supply of fresh water?
So our changing climate is releasing fresh water from storage in glacial ice. It's running into the ocean and not being replenished at an equivalent rate. Therefore, not sustainable given our predicted rate of warming. And it's going to cause major transnational issues for countries such as China and India in the medium to long term. We therefore need to act now to avoid this.
What do you mean, transnational issues?
So water that in the Himalaya that people are dependent on in those major countries, I think we're going to increasingly see the potential for treaties that have brought people together may be subject to increasing tension as we get increasing shocks and strain, shocks and stresses across the water cycle.
Now, we've got to get fresh water to where it's needed, and for that we need infrastructure. Is the world's fresh water supply infrastructure sufficiently resilient, or are there major shortcomings?
Well, in the medium to long term, as our planet warms, our climate changes, and as our population grows, there are significant shortcomings, I'd say. An alternative question may be, as we've just discussed, with this rise in urbanisation, are our cities resilient to the shocks and stresses of a changing climate, given the increase in urbanisation? Our failure to reduce carbon emissions is inducing sort of unsustainable warming, evident in the Greenland and Arctic ice sheets. So from a resilience perspective, I think we're going to be experiencing more extremes, and I'm not sure our cities are currently sufficiently resilient to manage those.
Why? Where are the shortcomings?
I think our shortcomings come around cities that have never experienced things like extreme storms. Copenhagen had a cloudburst with a 1,000-year or rainstorm that paralysed the city. So they're now seeking to create lots of blue and green spaces within the city to help soak up the same sort of an event. And if we get bigger storm surges, like almost just hit Miami, those could be quite dramatic. And at the moment, those cities just aren't protected or prepared for those sorts of events.
Uh-huh. Now, is enough being done to recycle water or to reduce water wastage?
I think much more could be done in terms of education of people around water efficiency, behavioural change. Maybe we could share more examples of best practice where we've used recycled water of an appropriate quality for a specific purpose. And we might even use economic instruments such as water tariffs. In Singapore, I think they use non-potable recycled water for industrial use, and they call it new water. And that's seen very much as leading the way in terms of changing the way people think about using water of different quality.
Can recycled water be used for drinking water?
It can't. In theory, it can, but at the moment there's a significant social issue around people drinking recycled water. Though I understand in Australia, where they're experiencing extreme drought at the moment, they are looking to commission their recycled water plants to start to use them as part of, potentially as part of their potable water system.
So it's a social problem then, drinking recycled water, not a health problem.
It is really, and ironically, I think people struggle with the concept of wastewater and it being recycled and whether that water's clean enough. But in reality, what happens, our bodies are continuously cycling water through the system, and that water cycle is continuously replenishing itself. So it depends on the scale at which you look at it, whether it's a social problem or not. I think it's all part of one cycle, and I wouldn't have a problem drinking recycled water, directly recycled water from a wastewater plant.
Now, which countries or regions in the world are most at risk, do you think, from fresh water shortages or scarcity?
In some ways, I think the greatest risk lies with the centres of global population. We've just seen Chennai run out of water. In China, there's major infrastructure like the South to North Water Transfer Project where they're implementing that. So sometimes it's water quality, not just quantity, that's the issue. Although fresh water shortage is only one of a series of climate change impacts, there's other things like heat stress that's going to kill large numbers of people, as has happened in France and Japan. And sometimes I think we look at water very much in a silo, whereas it's part of a series of changes in climate, some of which can be significantly more damaging to human health. Or
right.
Even to fatalities.
Now, is there a relationship, do you think, between fresh water supply and conflict? And how do you see this could change in the future?
I think it's a really good point. I think Gorbachev talked about water wars, didn't he? Some research we did over 10 years ago indicated something like, well, more treaties have brought together people than have caused conflict, and it was something like a factor of 10. But if we think, if that was in a static condition, imagine a changing climate that causes increased tension in water access agreements and leads to conflict. And indeed, at Stockholm about 4 years ago, I was involved in debates about climate change and conflict, and it's shown that those are directly linked.
Really? Directly linked?
Directly linked, yeah.
Now, looking ahead, how do we reconcile the challenge of water scarcity and stress with population growth, urban growth, and the need to increase food production?
Good question. I think fundamentally we have to learn to develop our world sustainably and live within the resources of one planet. It isn't by chance we've talked about a food, water, energy nexus at the World Economic Forum and the need for us to think outside of our burrows and all come together to solve these things. I think transforming our view of the value of water so that we make decisions, planning decisions that take it into account in a much more significant way. But it's what we depend on for the future of life. So it's really important that we start to value it much more than we do. Every one of us is about 2/3 water. We tend to think of it as an abstract thing in the corner or in a bottle or in a tap. But actually, it's the whole fundamental essence of life.
Finally, are you optimistic that the future of water supply can be resolved amicably?
I am. I mean, as an optimist, my greater reservation is whether we can attach the urgency we need to climate change. And maybe the measure of whether we can deal with water and this wider sustainable development is our ability to achieve the sustainable development goals in a given time. And if we can do that, then bringing ourselves together to tackle the wider climate change issues that are fundamental, the existential challenge to us all.
Well, that concludes today's interview. Mark Fletcher, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Ian.
You're listening to Business of Weather, produced in association with Asia Climate Forum, Asia's largest event dedicated to addressing climate change, flooding, and poor air quality. The Association of the Hydrometeorological Equipment Industry, or HMEI for short, represents some 140 private sector providers of products and services in the meteorological, hydrological, environmental and related fields. Based in Geneva, HMEI is fully accredited to the World Meteorological Organization and other UN agencies and actively facilitates cooperation between its members and organizations across the public and private sectors. HMEI members have a key role to play in helping to address the growing impacts of extreme weather and climate change, and I spoke to the recently elected chairman, Jim Anderson, about his own company and the big challenges ahead for the industry.
Earth Networks is a weather and environmental monitoring technology company that's been in business for nearly 25 years now. We really specialize in severe weather nowcasting and alerting, and we serve large-scale enterprise and government customers who have business continuity or safety and efficiency needs that they're trying to meet for their weather-sensitive operations. As for myself, I've worked for Earth Networks for about 18 years now, and I'm kind of a weather geek and an environmental geek. I really started my career doing environmental public policy work. I studied wildlife biology and natural resource economics as an undergrad and pursued a passion in environmental policy That's what led me to move to Washington, D.C., and then really saw myself wanting to expand those efforts in the business community and working, you know, in the private sector. And that led me to Earth Networks. And it's been a really gratifying, stint at Earth Networks ever since. So that's kind of about me.
Now, you've just been elected chairman of the Hydra Meteorological Equipment Industry Association, or HMEI for short. What is the HMEI? What does it represent? And what are its objectives?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and thank you for asking. And it is, it's really an honor to have a chance to help HMEI in this capacity. HMEI represents the commercial weather technology and services sector within the WMO and in the broader weather information community. So working with the donor community, the academic sector, as well as the government sector, to bring the perspective of the private sector into that discussion. And that's really our role. What makes HMEI unique primarily is that we are, we have observer status and we have a firm agreement with the WMO to represent.
The WMO is the World Meteorological Organization.
Thank you. Within the World Meteorological Organization to represent the industry within that body. And so that's a great opportunity and a great responsibility for HMEI to as fairly as possible, in as honest a way as possible, to represent the entire industry, not only equipment manufacturers, but the services sector, really all elements of the private weather industry sector in within those WMO discussions.
Right. Now, who are the customers of the technology companies and the services providers who make up the HMEI?
Most of the customers are either government entities or large-scale private enterprise. And almost all the companies that I talk to are really working to try to solve, pressing challenges for government entities and the private sector as they adapt to climate change and they build the capacity within their organizations and operations to meet the weather challenges that they have. So it could be everything from, a transportation or telematics type of application where they're worried about road conditions and getting perishable goods to market on time, to a government organization that's trying to make sure that they get accurate alerts and warnings out to the general public to help save lives and property, to an airline, a mining company, an aid organization, a hydro organization, or a water company, an electric utility. Think about all of the weather-sensitive operations and functions that exist within our world. And now think about the increasing pressure that's on all of those different types of operations because of the impacts of climate change. And that's really, who our industry is serving. It's providing valuable technology and capacity and services and equipment to help all of those organizations meet the challenges that they have related to weather and how it impacts what they do, what our customers do.
Now then, how do you see your role as the incoming chairman of the HMEI?
I'm really there to help facilitate the discussion and bring the industry perspective in as cogent and concise a way as possible to the broader community. So I'm really here to represent as best as I can and as fairly as I can the voice of the private weather sector, the private weather industry. And in doing that, helping, you know, collaborate with and inform, you know, academia and the public sector about how the private sector can be a good partner in everything that they're trying to accomplish.
Now, the term global weather enterprise has been coined to describe all those from the public, private, and academic sectors engaged in the weather industry. What do you believe are the biggest and most urgent challenges facing the global weather enterprise and its customers?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, no doubt the biggest challenge in front of us are the impacts of climate change on all of our constituents, our customers, our citizens. And if there's one thing that I'm sure is true, it's going to require the efforts and the coordinated, cooperative efforts of everybody within that global weather enterprise to help meet the challenge. You know, and so whether that's, you know, us providing a service to a banking company so that they can ensure that they have continuity of operations, or whether that's helping a government entity have the information that it needs so that it can provide the most accurate and meaningful alerts and warnings to its citizens so that they can do everything they need to be safe in the event of a severe weather incident, or anything in between all those examples, right? It's helping. It really requires all the elements of the GWE working together cooperatively to meet those challenges. So I think we're all, maybe if there's one thing that we can all sort of get behind, that the private sector, the public sector, and academia are all trying to meet the same challenge. We're all in this together. And that's probably one thing that we can continue to reinforce and make sure we're really clear about.
Just how important is cooperation between the public, private, and academic sectors to meeting these challenges?
Yeah, it's immensely important. In many cases, a lot of the innovation and new technology and new ways of delivering services and analyzing data and creating products, a lot of that's coming from the private sector. We can help the public sector by implementing those advancements for them. Obviously, you need the public sector is immensely important. They are the single authoritative voice. They do have the absolute responsibility for helping protect life and property and supporting, civil society. And so the private sector needs to understand that and really respect the centrality of the government's role in that regard. And academia, a great deal of important research is being done there. Most private sector innovation in some way is fueled or initiated or catalyzed by work in the academic sector. And so there's a lot of synergy there. And then also, the private sector provides a lot of opportunity for academic institutions and a lot of the knowledge base that's being developed there to kind of take full flight and be brought into broad adoption to be fully commercialized. So I think there's just so much, there's this web of synergies between all the different players within the GWE, the Global Weather Enterprise. And so to think of it as sort of like these three nodes, you know, you got the private sector, the public sector, and academia, is a little bit of a misnomer, right? It's a little too simple. It's really this incredible web of interactions that, when it's done properly, can really foster a lot of, you know, wonderful development. And even when we think about public-private engagement or public-private partnership, that's not just a simple, and it certainly doesn't have to be sort of the simple, you know, kind of one-to-one type of interaction. It can be a web of interactions within a particular market or a geography that helps bring a lot more weather information to bear, and make a lot more weather information, intelligence, and applications available to a wide variety of players within a given market. And ultimately, that builds up the overall capacity there to help support the increased demand for this information, you know, the increased capacity necessary for climate change adaptation.
Okay, let's take out our crystal ball. Looking ahead, what changes do you see in the nature and the number of customers for the products and services of the global weather enterprise?
I think that it's a market that is absolutely growing and growing more and more rapidly. And that's kind of an anecdotal statement. I don't know that I've got firm data to support that, but certainly there's, you know, an increased level of investment in the private sector. You're seeing a lot of business activity, you know, growth of new businesses, mergers and acquisitions. So there's a fair amount of new investment coming into the market. Ultimately, I think that means better things for the large scale enterprises and government entities that we primarily serve. That's, you know, higher quality products, more sophisticated products to solve higher value problems that are going to be delivered to our customers.
Well, we'll conclude our interview there. So, Jim Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian.
You're listening to Business of Weather, produced in association with Asia Climate Forum, Asia's largest event dedicated to addressing climate change, flooding, and poor air quality. Many of us will be aware of Sir David Attenborough's program Blue Planet 2 and the problem it highlights of plastic polluting the world's oceans. Well, now it seems that plastic is also polluting the air we breathe. In fact, microplastics are being carried everywhere and anywhere by the weather, even to the world's most remote mountaintops. A study published in May by Nature Communications claims to show that microplastics are raining down just as hard in remote environments as they are in our cities. The study's authors, a team of scientists from the Ecolab Research Institute near Toulouse, collected samples from high altitudes in the Pyrenees that were far from sources of plastic waste. The nearest village was 6 kilometres away, the nearest town 25 kilometres, and the nearest city 120 kilometres. They found an average of 365 plastic particles were being deposited per square metre every day. To discuss this, I've invited two of the authors, Steve Allen and Dr. Dione Allen, into the studio. Welcome, Steve. Welcome, Dione.
Hello.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Right, let's get started. Now tell me about your research, how it came about, and why you chose the Pyrenees.
So we were working with a research group in Toulouse who does a lot of long-term monitoring in the Pyrenees Mountains. And the research location was chosen because it's part of a long-term monitoring station that has a very good atmospheric record for atmospheric chemicals, not plastic, and weather records that's been going on for sort of about 10 years or so. So it's got a good history, and there's a good understanding of how the atmosphere and the rain sort of processes work in that level of the mountain. or that area of the mountain. As far as plastics go, both Steve and myself have got a long record of being environmentally conscious. We've found plastic all around the world in our travels. And while we were doing some other research up in the mountain areas in the Pyrenees, we were aware of all of the plastics research that was going on and being published and becoming more and more well known. So the amount that's found in the sea, we've seen it in the middle of the Pacific, in the middle of absolutely nowhere, just floating around in the sea. We found it on beaches. And the research was becoming more attentive to what's going on in the land. So we're beginning to find it in the rivers and in the coast and on the terrestrial surfaces. But it seems like there's a massive mismatch. If you read a lot of the papers that are trying to do the mass balance of the amount of plastic there is in the world, there's a big gap, there's a big leak where we don't have the balance of plastic. There's a lot of plastic that's being theoretically lost out of the system. And both of us are paraglider pilots, and our logical thought was, okay, well, why do we not look up? We're missing a huge environmental compartment, and it just hasn't been looked at. So that's what we did. We looked up. So while we were working in the Pyrenees, we took the atmospheric samples that allowed us to look up for the plastics.
Okay, thanks. Now, were you surprised by your findings?
Yes. So... well, no and yes. Yes, because we were surprised by the quantity of plastics that we found up there and to some extent the size of the particles that we were finding. No to the fact that we actually found it at all. We're both pretty aware of how ubiquitous plastic is, and most people are now, about how it is absolutely everywhere in the world. So we were expecting to find some. We were not expecting to find quantities quite as high as we did. And when we first started doing our plastic counts, we did everything sort of like, you know, in triplicate and then triplicate again, just to make sure that our numbers were actually what they were, because the numbers are quite high. They are comparable to what we've been finding, or other people have been finding, in cities. So if you look in like Dongguan, if you look in Paris, the papers that have been published there identify high quantities of plastics. While we find a lot less in the mountains, we still find numbers that are within the range of what have been found in those city environments.
Let's put that into perspective. You were expecting to find some plastics, but how did the quantity you found compare to that? Was it two or three times more?
So, yes, I'd say close to an order of magnitude more than what we were expecting.
10 times more.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the plastics that have been published in snow in the Swiss Alps and the floodplains and stuff, then they're finding quantities that are almost about half what they're looking at in some of these city studies. And we were expecting to find maybe, you know, a tenth of that. And in reality, when you compare directly, we're getting somewhere around 40 microplastic particles per meter squared. By size, compared to what they're finding for the same size in the middle of cities, which is somewhere between two all the way up to sort of like 300 or so. The numbers are quite sort of interesting.
Okay. Now, are these microplastics toxic? What are the implications for human and animal health, or even agriculture?
We do know that what goes into plastic in its manufacture is extremely toxic. I mean, we've learned now that BPA and phthalates, BPA, bisphenol A and bisphenol B, and perfluoral alkyls and polyfluoral alkyls are highly toxic to marine animals and insects. But those are the ones that they use to create the plastic. The trouble is that once it's in the wild, the microplastic can then adsorb whatever it comes in contact with, which means the other pesticides, residual DDT, mercury, persistent organic pollutants and things like that actually stick quite well to plastic. Now, we're currently looking at whether or how much impact this can have on organisms. We do know that when plastics or materials are in the nanoscale, the submicron, that they can readily pass through bodily tissues, through the lungs, into the blood and the brain. Now, this is still very much in the early stages of research, but there's a lot of us out there who are terrified about what this means to us, considering that these nanoplastics can carry adsorbed materials and their own estrogenic endocrine disruptors into the brain directly.
So what does this mean for human health potentially?
At this sort of level, we don't know yet. It's too early in the research, but we are seeing that there's a lot of these endocrine disruptors and estrogenic chemicals from the plastic already showing up in human blood and human urine and umbilical cords from a study they did.
Now, do you think the problem of microplastics in the atmosphere is going to get worse, or is enough now being done to deal with it?
We're doing almost nothing about it yet. This problem is going to get far worse, and it's going to be much sooner than we think. There was a study recently released that showed that almost half of the plastics ever produced was done in the last 15 years. Now, that means that we are increasing our production and use of plastic and our mismanagement of it at such a rate that it's very likely that we will reach a safe point. We're going to exceed the safe limits of this plastic in the environment before we know what it is, well before.
So what about recycling, though? Isn't that working?
No. Recycling's a myth. It's it's around 9% if we take the government figures at their face value. But in truth, governments consider plastic as recycled as soon as it goes on a ship to go somewhere else. And most of that is not being recycled at the other end. So the recycling itself is not actually happening.
Right.
The definition of recycling doesn't currently function effectively. It's a misnomer for the people that actually do the recycling. This is not to say that the recycling that gets done should stop. You do need to recycle. We do need to do something positive towards managing the waste that we create. But the problem is not the management of the waste to create. It's the problem is the creation of the waste to start with.
Okay. Now, have you any idea where these plastics might have originated? Is there any way they can be fingerprinted or even traced back to where they originated or were even manufactured?
The fingerprinting is quite difficult because even the oil that was originally used to make the plastic could have come from anywhere, and the plastics could have been manufactured anywhere. So we can't really tell, and it doesn't really help us, because if it was manufactured in China or Indonesia and still was used in Europe, it's still a problem for Europe. And this means that, fingerprinting is very difficult.
Right. Now, finally, are you planning any further research?
Yes, we certainly are. We're currently working in Lyon for the University of Lyon 1, looking at ecosystem effects and toxicology of microplastics on fresh water. And we're continuing our aerosol work on airborne microplastics.
So we have a Levy-Hume research grant that allows us to look at or a fellowship that allows us to look at the atmospheric plastics on a relatively global scale to try and figure out what's going where and how much we have, as well as, the bioaccumulation within the terrestrial systems.
Okay. Well, Dione, Steve, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're listening to Business of Weather, produced in association with Asia Climate Forum, Asia's largest event dedicated to addressing climate change, flooding, and poor air quality. The weather impacts society at all levels, and accurate weather forecasting is crucial to improving safety, security, and prosperity for businesses and society around the world. Accurate weather forecasting also has a critical role to play when it comes to addressing the increasing impacts of extreme weather and climate change. Examples include early warning systems, which predict the impact and timing of severe weather events and help save lives, the development of more resilient power, transport and communications infrastructure, making buildings more energy efficient, not to mention increasing the efficiency of renewable energy, tracking the spread of infectious diseases such as malaria, dengue and Zika, and, of course, helping to create significant improvements in agricultural production. The critical ingredient of accurate weather forecasting is data, lots of it, and the provision of high-quality data tailored to the needs of weather-affected public and private enterprises offers a rapidly expanding number of new business opportunities. One company determined to take advantage of these opportunities is Orbital Microsystems, or OMS. To capture this data, the company is developing a fleet of microsatellites, and the first of these was recently launched on the International Space Station. To find out more and discuss the growing commercial opportunities of providing high-quality weather data, we spoke to the OMS CEO, Bill Hosser.
We are a global cloud-based weather platform focused on delivering rich and more accurate near real-time weather data that's actually delivered through a combination of microsatellite technology and our proprietary cloud-based data systems.
Now, we're going to talk about the opportunities to new business startups, etc. today. But tell me first, how would you describe the weather business and who are the customers?
So there are portions of the business that are pretty well developed, and that's the long-term forecasting businesses such as AccuWeather and Weather Channel and those. But in many ways, it's still really formulating itself because of the next generation capability of small sat and high value algorithms and very innovative next generation type of tools. It's broadly used. It's very critical to operations. So though it's new, it's something that's definitely going to be growing.
So what sort of companies, what sort of businesses, what sort of enterprises are going to require more accurate weather data, do you think?
This is actually what's a thing that makes this market so interesting to us, is really any industry can really improve their bottom line as well as their efficiencies by using weather. It can be either through the risk mitigation markets, transportation, agriculture, marketing, sports events. I mean, you can let your imagination wander, but that is what also makes it kind of challenging, is because the market is so open and so available, where do you start?
So as the weather appears to be getting more extreme, some put it down to climate change, then the customer base is likely to increase.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, you have major infrastructure nodes such as airports and railroads that are already looking at having to invest billions of euros into their operations just purely to protect what they have from future more extreme types of weather.
Now tell me, how exactly does OMS fit into the weather business? You've mentioned it a little when you introduce yourself, but what are your products and services?
Yeah, we really view ourselves as an infrastructure node for the weather business. We are not the company that does the algorithms. We're not the company that does the analytics. We are the company that provides the core data that these companies and organizations need. We're really focused on closing the gap of data availability and then the temporality of that data as well. So getting those observations faster, both in time of coverage, but also directly to the market. So, we're doing this really, by flying our own satellites, building our own data platform so that it can accelerate the to market path for Earth data.
Where do you see the opportunities then for entrepreneurs, new business startups, and, of course, for investors?
Yeah, so with two-thirds of the gross global product directly affected by weather and the other third indirectly, you name it. So I think the key areas, though, are with the erratic nature that we're seeing in weather, that now casting really is going to become kind of the next dream company area. If you can really monitor and deliver the critical decision information to those organizations that are in operations that are directly affected by weather, this really is where the huge opportunity lies. You've got organizations like Walmart that are looking to do robotic store resets based off of what the weather is outside. You have shipping companies that are in just, you know, like JIT situations where knowing how to save 15 minutes on a transit doesn't sound like much once, but when you do it thousands of times, it really makes the supply chain very robust. So, you know, those are just a few examples of some areas where we really see some opportunities.
Is it expensive to get into the weather business? And, you know, the investors, are they receptive to this sort of opportunity, do you think?
It's not expensive to get into it on the analytics side. From the direction that we're going, it is, because we really are building an infrastructure. You know, it's not cheap to come up with a new electric device, but it's very expensive to come up with the hydroelectric dam that generates that electricity. And that's kind of where we are. So it is very cap intensive. When you are setting up new satellite fleets to improve and increase the numbers and types of observations. But that in the long run, where the real point of the spear is, you know, there are lots of, you know, two-man and three-man companies out there doing very, very well by being innovative and creative with these new types of data sets that are becoming available.
What sort of time did OMS have getting off the ground as a business and talking to investors?
Yeah, it's it definitely has been challenging. You know, and previously you had asked about, are the investors receptive? Yes, they are receptive, but they are still fairly skeptical because we are still working with very, very new types of systems in the CubeSat and SmallSat world. We're relying a lot on some new launch capabilities to get into space. So there is a fair amount of cautiousness, but they, you know, the core of the investment market really does see the value of this, and you know, we're just seeing more and more investors stepping in as more companies, you know, are proving out their business models. So for OMS, we really are at the you know, top end of the downstream piece. And that is an area where there still is some challenges in raising money because they are large amounts of money. It's hard to leverage our developments outside of exactly what we're doing. So, yeah, it is a little bit challenging to get into the place where we are.
Now, you deal in microsatellites, and from what I understand, these are launched directly from the International Space Station. We've all heard about Elon Musk and SpaceX, and now we're seeing the likes of Richard Branson and Amazon getting into space. But is space critical to the weather business and making a business out of it?
Oh, it's paramount. Ground sensors give you high resolution, but in very, very small areas. They're also very susceptible to the exact kind of weather that they are trying to observe. So if you want a robust, resilient, and persistent data set and observations, especially as you know, we rely on this data more and more for safety, security, and prosperity, space really is you know, the best place to be doing these observations from. It actually sounds kind of strange to say sometimes, but it's the safest place to put your instruments, because once they're up and operating, they're very much out of harm's way. So space is hypercritical to the growth and sustainment of the next generation of weather capabilities.
Every day we read a new news story about how extreme the weather is becoming or the impact of climate change. But what does this mean for the weather business? Are there any specific areas which are coming along, you know, being developed now as a result of this growing intensity of extreme weather or the impact of climate change? Is there any one or two areas you could point to?
Right. Yeah, the extreme, the extremity of these weather events, the erratic nature of them based off of historic models, is definitely creating huge opportunities. Areas globally that are most susceptible to this and the greatest opportunities are places like Africa, Central and South Asia, and East Asia, where these regions have been underserved by observation. And but they also have the fastest growing populations, and they have some of the highest challenges for critical needs like food and safety and security. So what is really pushing these markets is being able to understand the risk level so that insurance can be offered, which allows that stability for societies to move into the prosperity part of their curve. Other things such as precision farming, being able to react quickly to unplanned weather events, huge growth market, all of the port protection areas, flood monitoring and protection. These are all areas that right now, the historic models just are not able to really close the gap, and we need to start relying on now casting and high refresh observations. And those really, again, are going to be the areas where the greatest growth and the most immediate impact is going to be seen.
Now, just to wind up, what advice would you offer to any research scientist, any postgraduate student who is has got their eyes set on a business startup of a weather-related business? What would you advise them?
Number one thing, know who your end buyer is. This is one of the challenges we hear all over the place with our partner companies out there, the other friends of ours that are tackling this amazing opportunity, is sometimes the person who is really the one that's going to be buying and using either your data or your product may not seem like the most obvious. Yes, insurance is a huge market for us, but is the insurance company really the key buyer for your data? Or is it more the support organizations around those insurance companies? So really, really know who your end buyer is. The other one is, don't try to go it alone. Don't try to do everything yourself. You can't do it. And the proof's in the pudding. There are companies out there that have tried to do the entire vertical chain, and it just becomes unwieldy and really hard for you to focus on what you do best. So focus on what you do best, find great partners to work with, and really have a shared end goal, which really is, let's take care of the people here on the planet. Things are getting rough out there, but we can definitely work together and make it a much safer and prosperous place.
Bill Hossack, that's it for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Ian, and best of luck with all your endeavors.
Well, that brings us to the end of the first edition of the Business of Weather podcast. To find out more about the stories and the people and research behind them, you can visit the websites www.moneyvista.co.uk and www.asiaclimateforum.com. Once there, you can also subscribe to the Business of Weather e-newsletter, which will keep you updated on new editions of the podcast and related information. In the meantime, we hope you've enjoyed the first edition, and if you have any stories you'd like to share or any services you'd like to promote, then please get in touch. Be seeing you.